compelling lifestyle. So it's up to us media activists to introduce his amazing character to the world.
Any media work that shines a brighter light on who Imam Reza was is precious in its kind. My work tried to explain the extent of love Iranians have for the 8th Imam, and I'm grateful that it was chosen as one of the best news reports on Imam Reza.
This is the second edition of the Imam Reza Media Festival. Aston Ghotz Razavi says so far there's been a rise in the number of works submitted from foreign countries. It hopes that with stronger participation from international media activists, the personality of Imam Reza will be introduced to a wider audience across the world.
Organizers say this festival creates a competitive atmosphere among media activists, and this will help boost the quality of productions themed with Imam Reza. The ultimate goal, they say, is to better introduce the character of the Shia Imam and his instructions to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Mashhad.
Europe is currently experiencing a heat wave. It means that overall energy consumption is lower than usual. However, winter is fast approaching. The EU has cut energy imports from Russia in retaliation for the war in Ukraine. The bloc has agreed deals with the US, Norway and Qatar to import liquefied natural gas.
Is this enough? No, I don't think it is enough. And this is the reason why on July the 20th we will come with further proposals.
If these proposals fall short, the EU faces a major energy crisis this winter. Economists are already painting a very gloomy picture.
We believe that we are going to face a recession during the winter, given all the headwinds we are facing right now, the energy situation, but also the cost of living situation that is having a strong impact on consumption.
Eurozone finance ministers claim all the blame rests with Moscow.
We started our meeting with a discussion on the economic situation, which continues to be challenging due to the impact of Russia's military aggression and all the global developments that arise from that.
Analysts say EU leaders are hurting their own citizens by placing enormous sanctions on Moscow. At the same time, Russia's economy seems to be performing well. Aside from soaring energy and food prices in the EU, there is worrying volatility in financial markets. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates. The euro is currently very weak, which has the effect of pushing up inflation even more. Croatia is due to become the 20th member of the Eurozone in January. The EU describes this as an historic step. The question is, will Croatians have much to celebrate by the time they start using the struggling euro? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
French President Emmanuel Macron has become the highest profile name tarnished by the so-called Uber files, a massive leak of company documents. The whistleblowing appears to detail the ride-hailing company's lawbreaking and collusion with political elites across the West. While economy minister under his predecessor, François Hollande, Macron apparently held secret meetings which resulted in secret deals that undermined laws created to regulate Uber, satisfy taxi drivers, protect passengers, and honor the national labor code. French leftist parliamentarians have openly accused Macron of favoring the interests of an American company over those of his own government. Macron faced similar accusations in 2015 when he guided the sale of French energy giant Alstom to America's General Electric. A defiant Macron shockingly said he would, quote, do it again tomorrow, even though Uber's promises of good jobs and economic prosperity have resoundingly failed in France and elsewhere and caused many indebted taxi drivers to commit suicide.
Taxi drivers are not surprised. We saw that Uber is not good at creating jobs, but for creating a new type of slavery. We love our jobs and our cities, and passengers understood that, and Uber has lost here. Uber dangerously does not respect the laws over and over again, while Macron needs this type of behind-the-scenes lobbies to inflict his type of politics.
Macron has often been accused of attempting the Uberization of all of French society. The accuracy of that criticism appears more just than ever.
Uber has reaped the consequence of their nonsense in France because the government refused to control them with our laws.
Uber is more expensive than taxis now and not popular. The Uber market can compete with the taxi market, but there has to be regulation.
The scandal is a reminder that while Western liberal economics claims to be based on fair, free market competition, political corruption is routinely employed to create monopolies, inequalities, and to subvert democratic laws. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Outside Belgium's largest asylum application center, located at Le Petit Château, close to Brussels city center. Dozens try to sleep, while dozens more queue up as they wait for the center to open.
I claimed asylum 1 year ago and I still have nowhere to sleep. You can see all the people on the streets. There's no place to eat or to have a shower.
Look at them, you can see the situation. This situation has been from a long time ago. When you claim asylum, so you shouldn't be in the street like this.
We escaped war in Afghanistan. We came here for help, but have to sleep on the streets and in the park. There is no help for us.
These homeless people are mainly from African countries and Afghanistan. None are from Ukraine. On the face of it, this might look like a Belgian problem, but perhaps we should be pointing the finger at the EU. The 27-country bloc has bent over backwards to provide housing and education for Ukrainian refugees and deliver a whole host of other benefits. Of course, nobody could argue with that. But is this not discrimination? That's a question we put to the European Commission.
Is there a two-tier unfair asylum system in the EU?
We work closely with the member states that they have under their competence and with our support. They need to follow up and ensure contingency planning and adequate support for all those fleeing war and persecution so that there is no difference in their treatment.
Critics say Western nations tore countries in Africa and the Middle East apart and now turn their backs on displaced citizens. This as there is no end of money to support Ukrainians. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New research puts the United States ahead of China, Russia, India, and Brazil in terms of global damage to the environment. with a climate expert saying the numbers are very stark. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Oliver Millman. The piece is titled Nearly $2 Trillion of Damage Inflicted on Other Countries by US Emissions. The United States has inflicted more than $1.9 trillion worth of damage to other countries from the effects of its greenhouse gas emissions, according to a new analysis that has provided the first measurement of nations' liability in stoking the climate crisis. The huge volume of planet-heating gases pumped out by the United States, the largest historical emitter, has caused such harm to other countries, mostly poor countries, countries through heat waves, crop failures, and other consequences that the United States is responsible for $1.91 trillion in lost global income since 1990, the study has found. This puts the United States ahead of China, currently the world's leading emitter of carbon dioxide, Russia, India, and Brazil as the next largest contributors to global economic damage through their emissions. Combined, these five leading culprits have caused a total of $6 trillion in terms of losses worldwide, or about 11% of annual global gross domestic product, or GDP, since 1990, by fueling climate breakdown. It's a huge number, said Chris Callahan, a researcher at Dartmouth College and a lead author of the new study of the overall economic loss. It's not surprising that the United States and China are at the top of the list, but the numbers really are very stark. For the first time, we can show that a country's carbon emissions can be traced to specific harm. The Dartmouth College researchers combined a number of different models showing factors such as emissions, local climate conditions, and economic changes to ascertain the precise impact of an individual country's contribution to the climate crisis. They looked for these links over a period spanning 1990 to 2014, with the research published in the journal Climatic Change. What they found was a perniciously uneven picture. Rich nations in northerly latitudes, such as those in North America and Northern Europe, have done the most to fuel climate change, but have not yet been severely harmed by it economically. Countries such as Canada and Russia have even benefited from longer agricultural growing seasons and reduced deaths from the cold as winters have warmed. Conversely, poorer countries such as those found in the tropics or low-lying Pacific islands have done the least to harm other nations and yet are suffering the brunt of the economic damage from climate change. The research didn't factor things not included in gross domestic product, such as biodiversity loss, cultural harm, and deaths from disasters, meaning the damage is in reality far greater. In places that are already hot, you are seeing it becoming harder to work outside. Mortality from the heat is on the rise. It's harder to grow crops, said Justin Mankin, a geographer at Dartmouth College and a co-author of the new paper. Justin Mankin added, "If you layer that on top of which countries have emitted the most, you get an almost perfect storm." Justin Mankin added, "There is this huge inequity. Countries like the United States have disproportionately damaged low-income countries in the global south and disproportionately benefited cooler, higher-income countries in the global north." Developing countries and climate activists have pushed for loss and damage payments to be made to those who are suffering the most from global heating through heat waves, through floods and drought. But the United States, which is responsible for around a quarter of all carbon emissions to date, has resisted setting up such a fund, citing fears that it will be held legally liable for the damages caused by its voracious appetite for fossil fuels. Fossil fuels such as oil, coal and gas. The pressure to alter this stance is ramping up again ahead of United Nations climate talks to be held in Egypt later on this year, with an alliance of young activists from more than 40 countries recently writing to the talks president to urge action on the loss and damage issue. The climate crisis has escalated humanitarian crises disproportionately, affecting the poor countries in the global south, the letter states, noting that the United Nations estimates that as many as 3.6 billion people around the world now live in areas that are highly vulnerable to climate disasters. For far too long, efforts to reduce carbon emissions and scale up adaptation have been utterly inadequate, exceeding people's ability to adapt. Therefore, loss and damage is now part of the reality of climate change and must be addressed. Progress, however, has been fraught. Wealthy countries have dawdled on a promise to provide $100 billion in climate aid to vulnerable countries, and any legal avenue to extract damages from the United States or from China is complicated by the fact that neither country recognizes the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, in The Hague, Netherlands. The chief impediment to claims by one country against another for climate damages isn't their scientific basis, it's their legal basis, said Michael Gerard, director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School in New York. Michael Gerard added, countries enjoy sovereign immunity against most kinds of lawsuits unless they have waived it. This impasse means some sort of negotiated deal remains the most likely way that the inequity of climate impacts is ameliorated. It's a positive step that this study is beginning to quantify the harms of these national actors. We can see the scale of harm is enormous, said Carol Muffett, chief executive of Center for International Environmental Law. Carol Muffett added, we're moving slowly towards some sort of accountability for this, as the evidence mounts and the record of US obstructionism in the climate context is established. I don't think it and other countries will be able to escape their liability in perpetuity, Carol Muffett added. The costs of climate damages are mounting, and ultimately someone will have to pay that cost. The question is, who will that be and how will it be done?
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Spotlight, I'm Kavitat Wai. While the U.S. President Joe Biden assured Arab leaders the United States would remain fully engaged in West Asia as he wrapped up his first tour of the region since taking office, some countries like Iran may be asking the question, who asked you to be engaged? Well, Biden has tried to spread Iranophobia amongst the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf, but it did not really go as planned, at least the way that he wanted. When he says, for example, quote, we will not walk away and leave a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran, is he saying that Israel will do that through an integration or defense pact, something that was not even discussed during his visit to Saudi Arabia? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille in France. Also joining us is Hamilton's Coalition to Stop the War, Kent Stone, who joins us from Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Elijah Magnier, let me first start with you. The U.S. president has left Saudi Arabia at this point. I'm sure you're well aware of it. There was lots of talk about the different goals that he had while he was there. Of course, lots of media coverage on this. What did he achieve during this visit to Saudi Arabia?
Thank you for having me. First of all, what he achieved is to show how he cannot maintain a word that he gave when he considers Saudi Arabia as a pariah. And he will maintain it as such. Secondly, he also confirmed that the United States is pragmatic and it has its interest in the first place and nothing else. And it looks after what the benefit it can get from all the country dealing with, and in particularly in the Gulf state. Thirdly, the Gulf countries agreed to increase the oil production in the couple of months in the summer when the request is high, particularly in the West and in Europe. And due to the war in Ukraine, it is not possible, as Saudi Arabia said, to replace a country like Russia that produces 9.5 million, well, it used to be 10.4, but now it's 9.5 million barrels per day, and the Gulf countries cannot replace it. We heard also that he could not use the word of Iran because we heard the Saudi foreign minister saying that only diplomacy is a language. Biden confirmed with the Gulf that what Iran has confirmed, that they doesn't want to have a nuclear bomb, and they said we don't want nuclear bomb. At the end of the day, Biden wanted to come to the Middle East to beg the Saudis and the Emiratis to pump more oil. And what we have seen, something very important for the Palestinian to see, how he spent only 4 hours and he said he will give them $200 million when he said he will give Israel $38 billion. So he did not mention the solution of the Palestinian problem. He did not mention the state of Palestine, if he's going to work toward it or not. He said only it is complicated. We all know that. It's been going on for the last 70 years. So his achievement basically is he broke the ice between Saudi Arabia and his administration, well, himself mainly, not his administration, because a member of his administration has been contacting the Saudis throughout the 18 months that Biden was in power. So at the end of the day, we see the diplomatic language adopted by the Gulf country. They want to live in peace with their neighbors. They confirm that diplomacy is the only language. They are not going to create an Arab NATO, regardless of all the speculation that were spread before the arrival of Joe Biden to the area. And I think that is positive to the Middle East and the Gulf.
Well, one of the things that he did use in terms of making sure that this threat remains, this perceived threat, and that is, Ken Stone, the Iran factor. He raised that on a number of occasions. One of them, he said that in the context of Russia and China, that U.S. That it accused Iran of what he called destabilizing activities in West Asia. Now, this is an old tactic that's being used. I call it a tactic because Iran is not a threat. It's not, you know, this whole nuclear weaponization of Iran's nuclear program is something that the U.S. has used in order to basically speed up Iranophobia in this particular trip. Did it work, do you think? Because we're looking at Saudi Arabia and Iran actually conducting talks. Iran, with this 13th administration, has extended a hand and has enhanced its ties with regional countries. So did it ring somewhat hollow?
Yes, it was hollow. I think that your other guest, Monsieur Manier, competently showed that the Gulf Cooperation Council prefers diplomacy to antagonism with Iran. The countries of West Asia, which we call the Middle East here, in an ethnocentric manner, witnessed the U.S. debacle in Afghanistan, and they came to realize that the U.S. could not protect them as it had promised all these decades. And now the countries of West Asia are starting to think a bit more independently about themselves and about relations with their neighbors. And so the Gulf Cooperation Council would prefer diplomacy now rather than hostility towards Iran, and quite reasonably as well, because Iran has not attacked any other country in almost 300 years, whereas the U.S. and its pit bull, Israel, have attacked dozens of countries in West Asia in the last 70 years. And recently, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and of course, constantly, the Palestinian people. So it's ridiculous to say that Iran is a threat to the stability of the Middle East. It's rather the hegemonic enterprise of the U.S. It intends to dominate the Middle East and, in fact, dominate the whole world. That is the real threat. And it gives unlimited resources, as Monsieur Manier pointed out, $38 billion this time, and continuous arms transfers and political support, enabling at the UN and everything to the State of Israel, which is used as an attack dog for the U.S. empire in the Middle East. Iran has the inalienable right under the International Atomic Energy Agency and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to have a peaceful nuclear program. And that's what they have. They repudiated the idea of having a nuclear bomb many years ago under Ayatollah Khomeini. And on the other hand, Israel maintains a secret nuclear capability and many nuclear weapons, which are never checked or verified by the IAEA. So it's a complete double standard.
Sure. Well, it's very interesting how the Saudi Foreign Minister, Elijah Magnier, came out in the open and put the issue at rest when it came to this so-called defense alliance that Israel was supposed to form with the regional countries, in which Biden obviously discussed that with Israel. And he said point blank, there wasn't any talk about this Israeli integration or defense pact, or I guess maybe the Arab NATO, if you want to also call it that, which, again, was one of the top priorities of the U.S. Why, then, was this not discussed, do you think?
First of all, because the Middle Eastern country, as the Egyptian president said at the end of the summit, can solve their problems with diplomacy between themselves. Therefore, they do not need Israel to be part of it, because the role of Israel is only destructive, and we have seen that with the Palestinian and the Palestinian territory and how they really dismantled the Madrid summit and the Oslo agreement, and they have no intention to give any right to the Palestinians. They just took their land and increased the settlement. Secondly, because the Arabs are not today in a position to start waging war against anyone. Thirdly, because many Gulf countries and Middle Eastern countries are meeting with Iran, talking to them. The Emirati came out just a couple of days ago saying we have no intention to be part of any allied group or organization or entity against Iran. So today there is no room for a belligerent like Israel and the U.S. to start pushing and waving the scapegoat Iran in the face of the Arab. It's an old-fashioned narrative that is no longer valid. Today there is business, there are development, countries need to look after their security by talking to each other, and this is what the Saudis did for four or five rounds with Iran in Iraq. And other Middle Eastern countries are not interested in spending money and sending men to do what? Where there is no war. The war in Yemen has been lost after 7 years, eight. We are starting the year eight, and the Saudis accepted the ceasefire. It's over. There are no more wars to be run in the Middle East. And by Biden saying we did not leave, it means he has left. His space in the Middle East is shrinking, is more narrow than ever. He's justifying himself, and the Arabs no longer take him seriously. And what is very important here, we're talking about countries who always depended in their security and their comfort and their ruling on the Americans. Today, they are saying to the Americans, we can solve our problem without you and, of course, without Israel.
Right. Well, it's really remarkable how what you are saying, in some sense, is starkly similar to what the Hezbollah Secretary General said a few nights back in his speech, Ken Stone, which I'm going to say, he said, elderly President Biden, by his age and his gestures, is an image of an aging America. It seems like the U.S. came to the region, didn't bring much to the table. You know, again, Iranophobia, the threat of Iran, which is a tired thing. There is talks going on, diplomatic talks going on with major countries that Iran is having. And also the fact that you're having Israel trying to be integrated, and that's not working because they have seen, as our guest there said, that Israel is all about force, it seems, and military. Obviously, we've seen how Israel has been attacking Syria. So is it that the U.S. is not being received because of its the way that its tactics are now old, and what it is bringing is not much for the regional countries to chew on?
Well, the big picture is that the U.S. empire is in deep trouble. It provoked a proxy war in Ukraine against Russia, and they thought that they could defeat Russia militarily by dragging it into another quagmire such as Afghanistan, and they thought they could defeat it economically by waging, by leveling harsh economic sanctions like the maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. uses against Iran. They thought that they could defeat Russia in that manner. But the big surprise is that the empire, the emperor has no clothes. The empire has no teeth. And when the empire laid sanctions against Russia, trying to cut it off from the economic system, the transfer system, the SWIFT system, and trying to prevent the transfer of Russian gas to Europe and the rest of the Western world, it backfired. And it backfired so badly that Biden, as administration, has been going around the world to try and beg any petroleum producers to please increase your production to make up the slack, because our vassal states in Europe, the European Union, they, when winter comes, they're going to be shivering in the dark. And so that was the primary reason that Biden went to West Asia, the Middle East, to talk to his oil-producing friends in the Gulf Cooperative Council. And they, you know, they had previously, at least the Saudi minister, the Saudi ruler, and the UAE ruler, the Emirati ruler, had previously even refused to take Biden's phone calls. This was unprecedented in history. And so he had to make a trip there to get down on his hands and knees and ask him to increase production a little. So the U.S. is in a situation they didn't anticipate when they launched their war against Russia, their mm-hmm. proxy war through Ukraine. And this is the situation that the U.S. empire now finds itself in, scrambling about to talk to Venezuela and other countries to up their production.
Sure. Well, Elijah Magner, I mean, if I'm Saudi Arabia and I'm looking at the way that the U.S. obviously has sanctioned Russia and its approach towards Russia in terms of the Ukraine conflict, we can then go to the G20 summit that happened recently, of which the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, warned China, saying that, you know, you are supporting Russia by buying oil from Russia. So if I'm the Saudi Crown Prince, I'm thinking, if I see that type of approach by the U.S., I would think, well, wait a minute. Saudi Arabia was the number one seller of oil to China. Russia took over that position, but it still sells a lot of oil to China. Wouldn't the Saudi Crown Prince then think maybe the U.S. is going to use the same pressure on Saudi Arabia, because we know that the China, U.S. has China on its radars?
Well, we have seen positions from Saudi Arabia that was remarkably new when Mohammed bin Salman rejected a call from Joe Biden to increase the oil just a few months ago that forced Joe Biden to come to the Saudi and beg for oil. That is clearly the upper hand of countries in West Asia over the Americans. If they united, they would form a very strong, powerful unity and country against the U.S. hegemony. Well, yes, China and Saudi Arabia signed strategic deals of many billions. Saudi Arabia and Russia signed also the commercial and military deals with many billions on the tables. That means the countries in the region, in the Middle Eastern region and West Asia, are shifting their attention, not completely from the Americans, because the Americans are still a superpower. They still have influence. They have 750 military bases in 80 countries. But today, there is a real challenge to the U.S. hegemony. So the world has been divided now between countries who favor the U.S. and Western allies, particularly, who are dragged along the U.S. against Russia, and the other represent the rest of the world not agreeing or even opposing the U.S. policy and its unilateralism that wages war and economic sanction indiscriminately against entire population, not only West Asia, but also in Latin America and in different parts of the world. So that is started today. There is a real challenge to this hegemony. Doesn't mean that U.S. that dominated the world since 1991 at the time of the perestroika until 2015 when Russia stepped in Syria. It means this challenge is serious. Russia and China are together with the BRICS country, with Iran, and they form more than a third of the population. And with all the countries that are not standing with the U.S., are two-thirds of the population. So we see the West on one side and the rest of the world on the other side.
Sure.
That is very significant.
It is indeed. Another selling point that the U.S. had, Ken Stone, which I'm trying to, again, figure this out, is that it assured the regional countries, in particular Saudi Arabia, that it's going to provide it in security, that it will make sure that it will provide security for it. Now, I'm not too sure that can be logically actually applicable when you take a look at the way that Saudi Arabia lost the war in Yemen, or when it comes to even Israel, when that Iron Dome did not really work that well the last time around there was a war on Gaza, where you had many of those rockets penetrate and pass by the Iron Dome. And other countries, does this, again, show that this is not something that the regional countries are buying, that the U.S. is really not capable of just coming to their rescue, assuring them of their safety?
Well, I think your other guest, Mr. Manier, he may not have used the words, but I think that he made the point that the U.S. Is no longer the sole superpower in a unipolar world. We are now into a multipolar world where Russia and China provide provide a center upon around which other countries can rally to resist the U.S. Attempt for hegemony over the whole world. The U.S., contrary to what to Biden says, where he will not walk away and leave a vacuum to be filled by Russia, China, or Iran, in West Asia, the U.S. has not left anywhere. They are still occupying Iraq, even though the Iraqi government passed a resolution after the assassination of General Soleimani asking him to leave. They are still sitting on Syria's oil fields and stealing the oil and the wheat. They are still in Libya. They are still helping the Saudis in attacking Yemen. So they haven't left, but people in the region are asking him to leave or to keep their hands off and let them deal with their neighbors independently and diplomatically and not be used as tools in the U.S. quest for hegemony.
Thank you very much, Kent Stone, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, and thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Yikova Tatway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
In the limelight.
Changing habits can be hard, but even partial shifts from meat-based menus could significantly decrease planet-heating emissions. We now present you an article written by Amanda Shupak. The piece is titled, Climate-Friendly Diets Can Make a Huge Difference, Even If You Don't Go All-Out Vegan. Chooses what you eat. If your answer is, I do, you're partly right. You may buy your own groceries and order your own restaurant meals, but it's the food industry that determines what is stocked on store shelves and listed on menus in restaurants. Matthew Hayek, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at New York University, says, the institutions all around us affect food choice. He said your choices are whittled down by what's in the supermarket, your workplace or school canteen, the restaurants in the strip mall on your way home. That means that for people who want to reduce the carbon footprint of their diets, the greenest option isn't always on the table. Or if it is, it isn't the most appetizing or convenient of options. What we eat has an enormous environmental impact. Scientists estimate that food production causes 35% of planet-warming greenhouse gas emissions, with meat responsible for more than twice the pollution of fruits, grains, and vegetables. In April, a report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, urged world leaders, especially those in developed countries, to support a transition to sustainable, healthy, low-emissions diet to help mitigate the worst effects of the climate crisis. But experts stress the burden can't rest on individuals making personal food choices. Producers, retailers, restaurants, workplaces, and governments must all help make plant-based foods convenient, enticing, and tasty. According to a report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, eating less meat is one of the most meaningful changes people can make to curb greenhouse gas emissions, help reduce deforestation, and even decrease the risk of pandemic-causing diseases passing from animals to humans. The shifts needn't be extreme. The report found adopting a healthy Mediterranean-style diet, rich in grains, vegetables, nuts, and moderate amounts of fish and poultry, could be nearly as effective as going vegetarian. According to one study, if everyone met basic nutritional recommendations, which for most people in developed countries means more fruit and more vegetables and less red meat, emissions could fall by as much as 29% by 2050. Caroline Bushnell at the Good Food Institute, a non-profit organization that advocates for plant-based and cultured meat, says, "But it's hard for people to change their diets. Consumers often say they're motivated to eat more healthily and more sustainably, but if given the choice between the dish that is better for the planet, but not specially appetizing, and a mouth-watering, meat-heavy option, people tend to listen to their gut and not to their conscience." Caroline Bushnell says, "It's like offering someone the choice between fries, French fries, and a side salad," adding, "Most people don't pick the side salad. It's not really an equivalent option." She said, "The Good Food Institute wants large food manufacturers and processors to change how the foods that people love are made," adding, "Instead of advocating for behavior change, we approach it from a supply-side angle." Big meat companies and consumer food brands are banking on plant-based proteins and laboratory-grown meat to help them respond to a growing appetite for more climate-friendly foods and to cut their own emissions. With more products to sell, retailers too need to push non-animal proteins. For example, Britain's largest supermarket chain, Tesco, set a 5-year goal to increase sales of plant-based proteins by as much as 300%. Caroline Bushnell says getting consumers to put plant-based alternatives in their shopping carts starts with placing those products next to things they're alternative to. Meat-free burgers near the ground beef, vegetarian cheeses among conventional goudas and mozzarella cheeses, rather than relegating them to a speciality section. Placement in the refrigerated section was crucial to bringing alternative milks mainstream. The tactic was pioneered in the 1990s by the founder of Silk, who started packaging his company's soy milk in traditional milk cartons and persuading grocery stores to stock them in the dairy case. Now, cow milk mingles with a bevy of nut and grain milks, and 90% of alternative milk sales come from the fridge rather than the shelf-stable aisle. However, the infiltration of alternative protein companies into supermarket real estate has not been without pushback. Several states, with pressures from farm associations, have passed laws restricting the use of words such as burger, sausage and hot dog on plant-based products on the basis they could mislead customers. A similar law was voted down in the European Union, though the bloc still prohibits labelling vegetarian products with dairy names. Caroline Bushnell says consumers are not confused. They don't think when they buy a plant-based hot dog, it's a beef hot dog, but they understand how to use it. In 2020, the research non-profit organization the World Resources Institute released a report looking at the most effective ways to encourage people to eat less meat based on the psychology of food choices. The researchers wrote one of the strongest conclusions was that decision-making around what to eat is rarely a rational and carefully thought-through process. People crave familiarity and are influenced by subtle physical and linguistic cues. The report advises those in the food industry to offer more plant-based options, make them taste good, and make them sound good. Research shows while fried chicken is crispy and burgers are juicy, Menus often describe plant-based options as healthy, vegetarian, or meat-free, none of which makes people want to order them. Using language to evoke flavor and mouthfeel rather than healthfulness or ethics makes people substantially more likely to order a vegetarian meal. When the cafes of the UK food retailer Sainsbury's renamed their meat-free sausage and mashed potatoes Cumberland Spice Veggie Sausage and Mash, sales shot up by as much as 76%. Other linguistic nodges can promote vegetarian options by highlighting their environmental benefits. Among the most effective messages, in WRI's research, were calls for people to be part of something already happening, or they were easy-to-understand comparisons. Swapping just one meat dish for a plant-based one saves greenhouse gas emissions that are equivalent to the energy used to charge your mobile phone for 2 years. Sophie Atwood, a senior behavioral scientist at WRI, says, "Both of those are all about making an inconsequential choice a bit more consequential." Sophie Atwood says it also helps to put vegetable options on the top of the menu and interspersed with, rather than segregated from, meat dishes. Studies have found making vegetable meals the default choice makes people many more times likely to order them. Companies and institutions can lower their emissions by offering more plant-based meals. Edwina Hughes, head of the World Resource Institute, WRI's Cool Food Programme, which has pledges from more than 50 organisations to reduce the climate impact of their food by 25% by 2030, says, "They are the most important changes that an organisation can make. What are you serving? What's the ratio of vegetarian to meat-based dishes?" But some experts say real change needs to include legislative measures, such as taxing meat, as some European countries are currently considering. It seems unlikely in the United States, even though one study found more than a third of Americans would support it, even as inflation pushes up food prices. Hayek says making progress requires all the tools available, educating people about food's climate impact, giving them more and better plant-based options, guiding choice by changing the default, offering incentives and imposing disincentives such as taxes, restricting and in some cases eliminating most meat options, as some European universities have. Hayek says it worked to curb smoking rates and it could work for food.